With over 7 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast about the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Cass, today we will discuss the life and career of the greatest designer Spain has ever seen, and one just might argue Paris too, because I bet if you ask any fashion historian or fashion journalist to rank the greatest of the greats, his name will absolutely appear on that list. You know, he is the man that Christian Dior declared, quote, the master of us all, which is really a supreme compliment when you consider Dior himself was at the very apex of his own legendary career at that time.
Yeah, and we are, of course, speaking of Cristobal Balenciaga, who in many ways is an intriguing enigma, even to us fashion historians, because he left us with an extensive and incredible body of work. But unlike designers such as Paré, Dior, Balmain, and others, he did not leave behind a memoir. And in fact, in the 50 plus year time span of his working career, he never even granted a single interview. So we really depend on his clothing to speak to his legacy.
Exactly. And the clothes, I mean, once you have seen an original Balenciaga garment in person, you understand the precise perfectionism of this man who single-handedly undertook experimentations in construction and silhouette that stunned the world and earned him a legion of loyal customers from all over the globe.
And to learn more about Cristobal Balenciaga, we are delighted today to be joined by Miren Arzaluz, the director of the Palais Galliera in Paris, which is one of the world's foremost collections of fashion and textiles. And she is most uniquely qualified to speak to us about the man, the myth, Balenciaga, because prior to her tenure at the Galliera, she served as the head curator of the Museo Balenciaga, a museum in Spain dedicated to his life and career. So welcome, Miren.
Miren, thank you so much for joining us today on Dressed.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, we really couldn't be more thrilled to be discussing the life and career of Cristobal Balenciaga, because few, if anybody, on this planet knows more about him than you. Can you tell our listeners how you first came to be studying his work?
Well, I was actually in London when I decided to study dress history at the Cultural Institute for Art. And when I had to choose my subject, my theme for my dissertation. And it came like a natural thing to choose Balenciaga, whom is something I knew from before. He's also Basque, like I am. And it struck me that I knew very little about him. And there was all this myth around him, you know, this Spanish couturier in Paris who arrived at a, you know, relatively late time in his life and suddenly got this amazing success. And everybody talked about his origins as an obscure part of his life. And I wanted to discover these origins because this is precisely where I came from. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know more about the man, about where his origins and how he had been forged in a way.
Right. And this actually evolved into a professional position as the curator of the Cristobal Balenciaga Museum in Spain. And the location of the museum is especially significant. And tell me if I'm saying it right. Is it Guattara?
Yes, Guattara. Absolutely right.
And because Guattara is not only his birthplace, but it's also, like you said, located in the Basque region of Spain.
Yes. And
for any of our listeners who may not be familiar with the geography or the kind of very specific, unique culture of this region, can you give us a little bit about background?
Well, Basque people is, it's a very distinct culture with a very distinct history and a very peculiar language, which is the oldest language in Europe, alive. And you have Basques in both sides of the border. You have Basques in France, and you have Basques in Spain. So Balenciaga came from the Spanish side of the Basque country, from this very, very small fishing village called Guattara, which is nevertheless a fascinating place to have been born at this particular time in the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And he was born in January of 1895, if I'm correct.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the circumstances of his birth and his early family life?
Yeah, well, he was, his father was a fisherman and his mother was a seamstress.
Mm.
So he basically learned how to sew with his mother, who played a very, very fundamental role in his life. And his mother, his father, he had been also mayor of the town.
Mm.
But what is most important, or maybe when it comes to Balenciaga's, you know, sort of passion for couture, is that he worked for the Spanish royal family during the summer because he was a captain of a small boat which was dedicated to custom surveillance during the year.
Mm-hmm.
But since the Spanish royal family spent their summer in nearby San Sebastian, which is it was at the time already a very important international summer resort.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked for the royal family during the summer. And that would, of course, give Cristobal Balenciaga, when he was very young, when he was a child, well, a vision of sort of also fashions of the royal family. And his mother, well, he was very, very important. She taught how to sew to the girls in the town, but she also worked for prominent families in the area. And these were prominent families who came to the Basque Coast following the royal family in the summer. Because it was not only San Sebastian, it was neighboring Biarritz, which is a Basque town in the French side
right.
of the Basque country, which was an even more important international summer resort. So it was all this sort of microcosm mm-hmm. of luxury that brought very many prominent families, Spanish and from elsewhere, international families, to the Basque Coast. So she had this very important client called La Marquesa de Casatorres.
Oh, you beat me to my next question
yes.
for you, so
yes,
thank you.
She was very, very important figure for Balenciaga when he was a child. And in fact, it was him himself who told this story. And this is very important because, as you know, Balenciaga only gave two interviews in his whole life.
Yes.
It was two interviews he gave after he had closed his house and not during his career. And it really struck me when I was doing research about him that he would speak precisely about this early time in his life, of his childhood, his origins, his time in Getaria in San Sebastian. So it must have been very, very important for him. And so he tells himself how he... Of course, he knew La Marquesa because mm-hmm. He was a very good client of his mother's. But he was fascinated by this woman who came to Mass every Sunday, as he himself told, coming down from her Tilbury, dressed in these glorious Sunday dresses, which were probably Paris haute couture, because I've seen afterwards, I have been the chance to see some of the family archive papers and of course it's full of receipts and all sorts of documentation from Worth, Paris, and all the couture houses. So you can only imagine what she was wearing. And he was brave enough to present himself. He must have been very young, around 10. So he introduced himself to her and he asked her a favor from her. And this was, would I be able to see your wardrobe? So she must have been completely...
Very precocious 10-year-old child.
She must have been completely taken by this completely unexpected request. And she said yes. So every day after school, he wouldn't play with his mates from school. He would just go to the villa that the Marquesa had in Getaria,
mm-hmm.
to the top floor, where the servants of the house would be ironing, would be taking care of the wardrobe of La Marquesa, and he would have this time for himself to study every single detail,
wow,
every single pleat, to study the textiles, the materials, the construction.
Mm-hmm.
So he had the best school of haute couture ever, without even stepping out of his very little fishing village.
Yeah.
So it is an extraordinary training experience.
And we've talked about this on Dressed before, that not only did training start at so much of a younger age, but a lot of the great designers throughout history, their passion really had revealed itself like before they were even 10 years old.
At such a young age, yeah. Yes, of course.
But he did actually officially train as a tailor,
yeah.
I'm correct. And he started again, young, at the age of 12 in San Sebastian. What happens there kind of rather quickly? What are his early years working as a tailor in San Sebastian?
Well, I think the tailoring was a very important part of his training. And I think you can actually understand his work, his later work, and his achievements, technically speaking, when it comes to construction, thanks to this very important tailoring training. Mm-hmm. And so this was his very first years. And then he went into work very briefly in Au Louvre establishment in Saint Sebastian, so it was a franchise from the Paris headquarters, and then he very early decided to do his thing, mm-hmm. and well, of course he knew Paris and all couturiers and couture collections very early, so probably at the age of 17, 18, 19, he was already traveling to Paris to know this world that fascinated him, mm-hmm. and very early on he decided to do his thing. The interesting thing is that Saint Sebastian was such an interesting place when it comes to fashion and luxury, that he could do this without having to move to Paris.
Yeah.
And so he opened his house in 1917. At first he had some associates, but then he was alone from 1924 onwards. Mm-hmm. And so he became a very, very well-known and consolidated couturier, first in Spain, but of course I'm persuaded that he was very well-known in Paris as well. Mm. Not only because there were many Parisians in the Basque Coast following this sort of summer resort experience, but also because his companion, his lifelong companion was Parisian, mm-hmm. and he was very well connected. So he was, I mean, if he didn't move to Paris until so late, it's because he didn't really need it. Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right. And in Sebastian, and then spreading into other cities, including Madrid and Barcelona.
Yes.
He kind of undertakes an interesting business structure.
Yeah.
He has multiple businesses running at the same time.
Absolutely.
One of them being under his own name, Balenciaga. The other one being a shortening of his mother's last name. Will you tell us about that, which he founded in 1927?
Asa. Yeah, of course. These were very convulsed times when it comes to the political and economic situation in Spain. So when he started, it was a very, it was a golden time for him because he had the royal family as client. I mean, all the ladies from the royal family, including the two queens who were his clients from 1925 onwards. So it was, you know, the golden age of also San Sebastian as a summer resort. But then, political changes came and it would be too long to go into detail. But he adapted himself mm-hmm. To the changes. So he continued doing haute couture in, you know, following the Parisian model. But he also did sort of in between business models. Mm-hmm. So something in between haute couture and ready-to-wear.
Mm-hmm. I like to call it demi-couture sometimes.
Demi-couture? Okay. So this is exactly what he would do.
Yeah.
He would continue doing haute couture, following the Paris model, but he would do a sort of demi-couture as well. Mm-hmm. And he used different names and different brands mm-hmm. to differentiate his work, which was always sort of directed to a different public.
We're going to take a short sponsor break. And after we do, we're going to hear a little bit more from Miren about Balenciaga's work in Paris. Welcome back. I'd like to turn our attention to the clothes themselves here for a moment, because that's something that we really haven't touched on. And there's been a lot written about the influence of Spanish culture on Balenciaga's work. So what were his inspirations at this early part of his career, and how did it play out in the garments?
Okay, well, I think he was, first of all, he was fascinated by fashion history. Absolutely fascinated. He had his own fashion, historic fashion collection. He collected textiles, he collected garments from the 18th, 19th, early 20th century. He had a very beautiful fashion history library. So he was fascinated, you know, on top of everything else, by fashion history. Of course, for him, you know, his cultural references were the art of his country, especially from the beginning. And I have to talk about La Marquesa again, the Marquesa de Casadores, and his husband, Cesario, Aragón Berrota Lamar, because they had the most fascinating art collection. And so not only did this couple introduce him into the world of haute couture, but it would also be an introduction to the world of Spanish art, because they had the most incredible collection of Spanish masters.
So it's almost like an overall cultural education.
Absolutely.
That he had.
Yeah.
You know,
of course, it was not formal education.
Right.
But when it comes to inspiration and, you know, aesthetic references and you know, not only cultural reference, but the most, you know, obvious aesthetic reference mm-hmm. are there from the very beginning.
And it's interesting because Bettina Ballard, the great fashion editor, wrote something rather controversial. If you really dig into what Balenciaga scholars like yourself have to say, you know, she said that she wrote in one of her memoirs that he didn't know a lot about fine art.
Yeah.
But I think...
She said something terrible, like he doesn't know the art or history of his country.
Yeah.
It was very tough. But, and I don't think she meant it. She meant any harm because she was really a good friend of his and she was invited to his house in San Sebastian very often. And so she got very close to him, which was not the usual thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he just didn't share these things. He didn't care about what others thought and he didn't spend 1 minute explaining his work to people. He just wanted his work to talk for him. So as frustrating as that can be for people like me who want to know more about him or what he thought about his work, we know nothing apart from the work itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks for itself. I mean, the colours. It's also, I mean, I don't want to underline the fact that he was Basque too much, but it is true that it's a frontier culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very strong input of Spanish and French culture. And, you know, the more the sobriety mm-hmm. of his work, the darkness sometimes
color
of his
palette, that's what I was gonna
say. The color palette is you could say is very Castilian, and so you've got you know this intense black which he used not only because a lot of people talk about black in Balenciaga as you know a sign of his also his religiousness and his you know this inspiration of Catholicism, etc., which is of course true, but he used black especially or as well. To focus the attention on silhouette.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the most efficient way of avoiding distraction from what he was most interested in, which was experimentation with silhouette.
Right.
And so, well, but then, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, all these references are very obvious to religious dress, the color palette.
Lots of lace.
Yeah. But it's also a way of, you know, this sobriety that mm-hmm. he was talking about, this... The absence of unnecessary adornment. This is very Castilian, very Basque as well. And it's all there. And the colours, I was talking yesterday with one of our curators, Pale Galea, who is the curator of Balenciaga in Black,
mm-hmm.
the exhibition that is currently at the Kimball Art Museum.
In Texas, in Fort Worth.
In Texas, Fort Worth,
and
yes.
I saw it in Paris a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Fabulous exhibition, and it looks fabulous at the Kimball too. And, you know, we were talking about this. The palette is extraordinary for Paris Haute Couture. You have the most, the strangest greens, blues, grays, the very, and these are colours that I can totally identify in Basque, you know, in the Basque country, the colours of nature. But which are not necessarily the colours that were often used in Paris Haute Couture in the 1930s when he arrived there. So, yeah, I mean, his culture is very present in his work.
Yeah. Speaking of the 1930s, political unrest plays out in the 1930s in Spain. What exactly happened and how did this affect Balenciaga's operations in Spain?
Well, in 1931, I mean, it's not the only... political change, but in 1931, it was the proclamation of the Second Republic in Spain. So, all the royal family, the aristocracy, fled the country, and this was a very, very big had a very big impact on Balenciaga's work because he lost his most distinguished clientele. So he really had to adapt. It's not that he didn't have any clients left because he certainly had, you know, intellectuals, artists, and the bourgeoisie of the Basque Country, which was very burgeoning middle class, and of course he had plenty of clients, but he was not. It's not that I want to classify, you know, clients, but it's true that they didn't have the same. How do you say this?
His business
in
took
a polite
hit.
Way.
Yeah, his business took a hit because some of his clients disappeared.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, his business took a hit.
So in 1936, with the official outbreak of the Spanish Civil War, Balenciaga left Spain briefly for London, which didn't pan out very well. So then he continued on to Paris. But what was the fate of the Spanish houses in San Sebastian, Madrid, and Barcelona? Did they remain open once he traveled and began working in Paris? They did, right?
As far as I know, yes, they did. Of course, it was not, you know, in full activity, but they remained open because he didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
Nobody knew what was going to happen. When a civil war breaks out, you don't know. The only thing you know is, well, Spain didn't seem the most appropriate place in the world for a couture establishment. And I'm convinced that he had already thought about moving to Paris before. It's just the civil war forced him to do it. Well, maybe sooner than he had expected to.
Right.
But he never closed his houses in Spain. So San Sebastian, Madrid, Barcelona, they kept on working. Of course, they kept they reassumed normal activity after the Civil War ended, especially in the early 1940s, and they became well a sort of a reflection of what he was doing in Paris. So he didn't do different things. Of course, he had to adapt his work in Spain to Spanish clients. It was, you know, during 40 years, there was this dictatorship in Spain, religious, you know, sort of religious thinking and a very conservative ideology ran the country for a very long time. So that affected also the way women dressed.
Right.
So you didn't have the most spectacular things that he presented in Paris in Spain, but it was really, really the same thing he was doing in both.
Interesting. Places. That was going to be a question that I was going to ask a little later. But let's talk about Paris now, if we will, because overall, right off the bat, overwhelmingly, his reception was quite warm. You've written a book about him, of course, which is called The Master in the Making. And you make a note that the French fashion magazine L'Officiel, they called his first collection that was shown in Paris as being, quote, full of taste and distinction, which is high praise from the Parisian fashion press. So was it just smooth sailing for him from then on? Did things just go quite well from the very beginning in Paris? Because World War II was only a short while off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had just fled the Spanish Civil War pretty much only to walk quickly into the Nazi occupation of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
What were those early years in Paris like for him?
Well, I think, after the opening, as you were just now mentioning, the reception by the press was very good. And this is why I also think he was already very known in Paris. You can't just arrive in Paris to the Mecca of fashion, open up a couture establishment and have this success, you know, coming out from nowhere. So I think he was very well known already, also by the press. So it was smooth in this way, but he had to fight a lot in the beginning, like everyone who starts a couture establishment in Paris.
Of course.
But it was smooth until the war broke out, which was only 2 years after, 1939, and then the Nazi occupation of Paris came in 1940, and it was a very difficult time for France in general, Paris in particular, and haute couture as well. So he remained open. He had a bit of a crisis. I think it's a fascinating episode, which has not been very much talked about. Because the Nazis closed his house, because he had used more material that had been permitted at the time.
Because rationing was in effect.
Absolutely, yeah. And so they closed his house, and he had to ask for help. For the help of the Spanish embassy at the time, which was an embassy of the new government in Spain, so the Francoist government in Spain, who was in very good terms with the Nazi regime, so he had a bit of a help to persuade the German occupants to reopen his house. But the most interesting thing in the letters that I found about this story is that the Germans considered that it was an exemplary sort of closure, not only because he had used more material that was permitted, but they made him responsible for the fashion of big hats in Paris at the time. And of course, this amazing, huge hats, yes, during the Nazi occupation in Paris have been a whole of a subject in fashion history, and it has been interpreted as a reaction to imposition, as a resistance, as a sign of resistance and rebellion. So I found it fascinating that the Germans considered Balenciaga to be the person responsible for this fashion.
That's interesting.
And it's fascinating, but he survived during the war. And which I find very interesting as well is when I talk about experimentation with silhouette and about all these sort of voluminous silhouettes that he started exploring in the 1940s and 50s, precisely started during this period, during the war years, because I found some sketches from 1942 with already this sort of thinking of body and silhouette, you know, this volume, this, it is precisely the complete opposite to Dior.
Yeah. And that was something else that I wanted to talk about, because it's this point where his work becomes more sculptural, like
absolutely
architectural almost. Yeah. One of my questions to you is, do you think that his inspirations for some of these things became slightly decidedly more Spanish in light of the fact that he was working in France now?
I don't know.
Or was just really the next phase of his career?
Yeah, I think he, once he felt himself established in Paris and, sort of known and celebrated, mm-hmm, already in the 1940s and 1950s, he started doing what he really wanted to do. And this is why his most extraordinary work is from the 1950s and especially from the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Most, sculptural, architectural, amazing abstract work is what he did in the last collections in the 1960s, mm-hmm, before closing in 1968. So I think he had this, he really started exploring what he really wanted to do. But I think he had been trained in this fascinating period of fashion history, which is the 1920s and 30s. And he admired all these women like Vionnet, like Chanel, like Louise Boulanger. These are women that he himself mentions as the best couturiers in the world, mm-hmm, in one of these interviews I was referring to before. And I think there was a lot of rethinking silhouette and rethinking the body in this early 20th century fashion. And this is what he's, in a way, he continued to do in the 1940s, 50s and 60s. We all assume when we do fashion history that with Dior, sort of we have this revival of 19th century silhouette and all these sort of achievements, in my opinion, of early 20th century stop after the war. But I think Balenciaga was precisely someone who continued in this vein.
Yeah, because at the moment when the new look was happening and women were becoming, re-corseted, wearing these very tight foundation garments, jackets were tightly tailored, Balenciaga's clothes were actually moving away from the body.
Exactly.
There's space between the clothes and the body, and that's just continuing that lineage of people like Vionnet, who he so revered.
Absolutely.
To turn our attention to Balenciaga the man,
because
he seems a bit mysterious to me. We read all these accounts describing him, his ateliers, and the word austere comes up over and over and over again. What was he like in person? And how did this translate into his working habits? He was a perfectionist.
Oh, yeah. But obsessively perfectionist. He was obsessed by his work throughout his life. I mean, he lived for fashion, for couture, for perfectioning the construction of his creation, really. And one of the two interviews I constantly refer to, because it's the only thing we have from him, really, is called La Vie d'un Chien, which is The Life of a Dog.
Mm-hmm.
That's the title of the exhibition, because he himself says something like, and I think it's for The Times, the Times magazine, in 1971, he says, under all this glamour, I realized that, I had the life of a dog. So he realizes that he's just left for working. Mm-hmm. He was insatiable. He was a perfectionist. He was obsessed by work. He was insatiable. He made very harsh judgments, but he was so harsh on himself. I think he was harder on himself than he was on everyone that surrounded him. But that made him very difficult to work with. But at the same time, he had this very human side of him. He was very generous. He helped people all the time without really saying or talking about it. And people adored him because of this. He had a sort of authority that, you know, no one else had. And you can see this also in the reaction of his contemporary colleagues like Dior or Chanel or Vionnet. Everyone talks about him with, well, admiration and respect.
Absolutely. You know, Dior, of course, declared him the master of us all. Mm. But he also said that I am Dior because of Balenciaga, which is a lovely compliment and also illustrates kind of like their complete different takes on fashion in the same moment in time. But he also, of course, we've spoken about this on Dressed already on our Givenchy episode, was a great mentor to Hubert de Givenchy.
Oh, yeah.
And also two very important couturiers would come out of his house being assistant designers, Courrèges and Ungaro.
Yes.
So what would you think the legacy of them training under Balenciaga was in their work?
Well, I think, in the case of Courrèges, it's so obvious, you know. Of course, he was a tailor at Balenciaga for 10 years. So you can imagine, and you can see that in his work.
Yeah.
I mean, the structure, the perfection of his tailoring, and how he used this in a revolutionary way in the 1960s. The same way as Balenciaga was a revolutionary in his own way. And it's a pity that he didn't train more people, I have to say. But it was such a close house and a close team that, you know, you wouldn't have a lot of people going around Balenciaga. He didn't socialize with many people. Of course, he socialized, and he was a much funnier character, a much, you know, more interesting character than some people would like to picture him, you know. He was a very closed man, he was a very reserved man. So he didn't share much either, unless you were very close to him.
Right. And you touched on this earlier, and this was something else that I was going to ask, because I know next to nothing about his personal life. He obviously had a lifelong partner. What was that relationship?
He had two partners. In fact, he had a very fascinating partner. His name was Vlatio Datenville. His father was Polish and his mother was a Parisian, and a very elegant Parisian aristocrat. And I think he really was very influential in Balenciaga's life. He, in fact, designed hats in the house. But he moved to San Sebastian very early on, because I found them living together in San Sebastian already in 1924.
Oh, wow.
So it's very early on. We don't know where they met.
It was his late 20s. He would have been 28, 29.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's a very early relationship. We don't know where they met. It could have been Paris, it could have been Biarritz, it could have been San Sebastian, precisely because of these people moving around the Basque Coast at the time. But he decided very early on to work with them in the creation of this couture house.
Oh, wow.
And, I've spoken with very few people who met him, because obviously they've all disappeared. But everyone seems to think that he was the most fascinating, elegant, charming, cultivated man in the world. And I think he must have softened as well, Balenciaga's character. And he must have, you know, sort of mediated. He must have been a bit of a, you know, the person who mediated between Balenciaga and the world in a way. But he died young. And that was a very, very hard blow for Balenciaga in 1948. And we have different accounts saying that he was on the point of closing his house, because he lost his mother and his partner almost at the same time.
Oh my gosh.
1948-49. And he had a major crisis and he was on the point of closing. And there's rumors said, you know, there's all these stories that you never get to really document, that Dior went to see him, you know, sort of begging him not to close, because, you know, haute couture without Balenciaga would not be haute couture anymore. So that's the story. I don't know if it's true, but it's a beautiful story anyway.
I like the story.
So he didn't close fine it, but it was very hard for him to continue. And his first collection after the death of his partner was really the blackest collection ever in the history of Balenciaga. And then he continued, and then in later on he had another partner who was Basque like himself, and who was completely different, but I think he really made his life much more cheerful. Mm-hmm. He brought some happiness in his life, yeah.
So we need to wrap up soon.
Yes.
But will you tell us a little bit about the end of his career?
Mm-hmm.
Because he did close up his Paris operations in the late 1960s. And I think a few years later, the houses in Spain continued on. But what was the reason for that closure? Was he just tired? He wanted to retire? Was there a specific reason?
I think mainly he was tired. He had been working all his life. And he was very tired. And also it was a moment where he understood, well, you know, this world is disappearing. You know, Paris Haute Couture, you know, in the wave of 1968, I mean, it's just a moment, a revolutionary moment in Paris and elsewhere. So fashion is undergoing a major change and couture is seen as a, you know, an old sort of a, well, a fossil.
Right.
Somehow, by all the younger generation who wants to be dressed and express themselves in a very different way. So,
and it would, on not to interrupt, but it would kind of be Carrège and Ongaro that picked up that mantle to do so.
Yeah, and in fact, it is the daughter of La Marquesa de Llanthol, who was a very, very, very loyal client of Balenciaga in Spain, who tells that. He used to say, you know, I would have done a beautiful prêt-à-porter, ready-to-wear, if I was younger. So this myth, you know, about him closing because he was offended by, you know, the lack of quality and, you know, he didn't want to continue in this horrible ready-to-wear, it's not true. I really don't believe that. He was much modern than that and he had been adapting himself to different situations all the way throughout his life. So I don't think he was, you know, an ideological stance. He just thought, well, I'm too old to start
a new venture.
Yeah, exactly.
From scratch.
Exactly.
I'm sure your collection at the Palais Galliera has wonderful Balenciaga garments in it.
Indeed.
Would you tell our listeners a little bit about your collection in Paris and maybe any upcoming projects that you'd like to speak about?
Yeah,
or tease?
The Balenciaga collection in Galliera is just wonderful. I mean, there are some really, really fundamental works of his career. But then what I find fascinating is that the things that he himself donated to the museum after he had closed his house, and knowing how perfectionist he was, to have decided to donate his work to a museum that, you know, it tells you a lot about what he thought about these particular pieces, these particular objects.
These are the ones. Are the ones.
Yeah, knowing how he was, it must have been something he valued very highly. And then what is very interesting is that his family also donated his personal historical fashion collection. And that tells a lot about him as well and about his work. And Palais Galliera already organized an exhibition some years ago, 2012, if I'm not mistaken, about him as a collectioner, mm-hmm. him and the influence of fashion history in his work.
Oh, wow.
And you could see, you know, the dialogue between his own work and the pieces from his own collection, the historical pieces mm-hmm. from his collection, which was a beautiful, beautiful exercise. And then, of course, we recently have done the Balenciaga in Black, which is, you know, of course, Balenciaga has a very vibrant colors in his work too, but his use of black is very particular. So it's a fascinating topic to explore as well.
And if any of you have already seen the show in Paris, like I have, I believe there are new garments actually included in the show
yes.
at the Kimball Museum. I saw an ermine dress and I was like, that was not in Paris.
No.
I would remember that.
That is a beautiful contribution of the Texas Fashion Collection. There have been some slight changes because of conservation, of course, as you know. Textile collections are very fragile, so sometimes we have to change some dresses. But then there's this amazing contribution by the Texas Fashion Collection. I mean, they have the most amazing collection in general, and Balenciaga collection in particular. They have like around 400 Balenciaga dresses there, which are just breathtaking. So it was only logic to incorporate the Texas Fashion Collection in a Texas exhibition, and we're very grateful.
I believe that's open until January.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Of course.
So you have time.
Yeah.
So Miren, thank you so much for joining us today on Dressed to talk about one of the most revered designers in all of the history of fashion. You know, this has been a real treat.
Thank you.
And please let's not let this much time pass until we get to talk to you again. Please come back and join us again for your next exhibition or any other project you'd like to talk about.
I would just love that.
All right.
I'll be back.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Miren, thank you so much for joining us today. We will absolutely take you up on that offer to join us again soon. April, I for one was especially intrigued by learning more about the early part of Balenciaga's career in Spain. I think it's generally known he came from Spain, but the fact that he was already a well-established designer with royal clients for nearly 20 years prior to moving to Paris, well, that really deepens the story of his work.
And perhaps also the little known fact that his fashion houses continued on in operation in Spain for several years after the Paris operations closed in 1968. I mean, I had no idea about that until I started preparing to speak to Miren for this episode, you know, and if you would like to learn more about his early career, you can check out Miren's book, Cristóbal Balenciaga, The Making of a Master, 1895 to 1936, which focuses solely on his time in Spain. And it is chock full of glorious images, Cass.
Yeah, and the Balenciaga in Black exhibition is currently up at the Kimball Museum in Fort Worth, Texas until January 6, 2019. So you still have plenty of time to see that if you are in the Texas area. Well, that does it for us this week, dress listeners. Perhaps you will consider wearing the master's favorite color, black, next time you get dressed. We will post plenty of fabulous images of Balenciaga's work on our Instagram at dressed_podcast, which is also our Twitter handle. And you can follow us on Facebook at dressedpodcast without the underscore. And please write to us. We love to hear from you at dressed@howstuffworks.com.
And do any of you need holiday gifts? Don't forget about our merch store, which is at teepublic.com/dressed. That's teepublic.com/dressed. And we do actually have a Balenciaga design.
We do. So check it out.
Yeah. Thanks to our producers, Holly Fry and Casey Pegram, and everyone else at How Stuff Works that makes the show possible each week. Catch you soon.
Bye.